Welcome, everyone. Usually we do our questions in the beginning and then teaching, but lately we've been having questions and not getting to the teaching. So I'm going to turn it around a little bit today, and we'll do the formal teaching first, and then there'll be time for questions at the end. Let me just say something about how to listen to a Dharma talk. We actually listen to a Dharma talk in the same way that we do our meditation practice. It's really another form of practice. In other words, the mind is concentrated, present, but also open. The presentation of Dharma is in a Dharma talk situation is not necessarily a presentation of ideas to be intellectually mulled over and grasped, even though, of course, sometimes it can be. It really is an opportunity, because the Dharma teacher is not simply trying to present ideas. A Dharma teacher is trying to help alleviate the suffering and the confusion of the hearers by presenting some teachings or practices that have the capacity to do just that. So it's good when listening to a Dharma talk, again, to listen with a very clear, aware, and present mind, and to just soak it in the same way that we could say thirsty earth, when it rains, it just soaks in the rain. So it can take it into itself to use to nurture and nourish the growth of life. And the mind of the listener, as is the mind of the presenter, is no different in the sense that neither one of us know what will happen next. We're just present to the experience. So what I want to share today is a very traditional teaching of the Buddha. I've sort of been doing a lot more recently of the various Zen masters. I'm reading from the Chanting from the Heart Plum Village book, from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, the beginning section. There are lots of ceremonies and different kinds of practices. And the latter half of the book is more traditional teachings, all just short. Taken from larger teachings, maybe a page, a few pages, 5 pages from various Buddhist, traditional Buddhist teachings. This is called the Elder Discourse. And when these teachings begin with such as this, I heard these words of the Buddha, these are teachings that are purported to be authentic teachings of the Buddha that were experienced during the Buddha's time by his disciples. And because this was a pre-literate society, which means they, if they wanted to pass on knowledge, they did a lot of memorization. This is how they attended to things. So many of the Buddha's teachings were attended to by some of his disciples, who perhaps had what we would now call a photographic memory. They had great capacity for retention. And then in the early years after the Buddha's passing, when his major disciples came together and kind of codified, what were authentic teachings of the Buddha as opposed to just hearsay, the ones they decided on all sort of begin with these words, you know, I've heard, or the Buddha say. So this one begins, I've heard these words of the Buddha one time when the Buddha was staying at the monastery of Chitta Grove in the town of Shravasti. And if anybody here has gone to India or goes to India on a Buddhist pilgrimage, you can still go to Shravasti. I've been there, and you can go to the Chitta Grove, and you can actually be in the same places where the Buddha and his earliest disciples lived and taught. Because after his passing, there were various kinds of what are called stupas, of monuments that were erected there, and over time his disciples developed monasteries and temples, and they became complexes of his followers, which over time fell into disuse over time. Got covered up and broken down, but then in the 1800s, during the time of the British, who had great interest in archaeology, many of these things were rediscovered. So I heard these words of the Buddha once he was staying in the Chitta Grove in the town of Shravasti. This time there was a monk named Tara, or elder, meaning elder, who always preferred to be alone. Whenever he could, he praised the practice of living alone. He sought alms, which is Buddhists would beg every day for their food. And he sat in meditation alone. So this is a very interesting teaching we're going to get into, because we're dealing with a monk who would outwardly appear to be living an exemplary life. Right? He lived alone, he practiced alone. He seemed to be very self-contained, very self-reliant, not dependent on anything. And obviously, he had great respect. And so I'll just kind of skip, but basically, one day a group of monks came to the Buddha and told him about this monk who only wanted to be alone, who only praises the practice of living alone, etc. He goes into the village alone, returns home from the village alone, and sits in meditation alone. Actually, if many people, when they read these early Buddhist teachings, are often bothered by the repetition. But I know from studying with teachers who still practice a lot of memorization that having lots of repetition helped them memorize these texts. So there's lots of repetition, same line over and over. So so the Buddha said to the monk, well, I'd like to meet this guy. So why don't you go and invite him to come visit me? They went to him, they invited him to come to meet the Buddha, and this Tara, this elder one, he came. And then the Buddha asked him, is it true that you prefer to be alone, to praise the life of solitude, go for alms alone, come back to the village alone, and sit in meditation alone? And the monk Tara said, yes, it is true. And then the Buddha, he asked him an interesting question. He says, how do you live alone? Again, he's the Buddha, you know, these are not idle questions. He's obviously up to something. So he says to Tara, you know, tell me, so how do you live alone? And the Buddha Tara again says, I live alone, but no one else lives with me. I praise the practice of being alone. I go for alms alone. I come back from the village alone. I sit in meditation alone. That is all. Seems very praiseworthy, doesn't it? So then the Buddha sort of addresses, because again, you know, the way the Buddha lived in those days, he lived very openly for most of his life. He and his disciples basically wandered about in northern India and always relied, they had no food, so they always relied on the local villagers or townspeople, whatever, to feed them and support them. And usually they would stay in these groves or gardens. They lived, we could say, in the open. Or during the rainy season they would erect. But basically the Buddha would just sit in the open. And so people would just gather around him, so anybody could, I mean, so even the dialogues he had with the people, if they came to talk with him, were sort of public. You know, there was an audience. Total transparency in those days. sunshine, total sunshine. So obviously this monk had made this disclosure in front of the gathered audience, and then the Buddha taught him as follows, but of course everybody could hear. And he says to him, it is obvious that you like the practice of living alone. I don't want to deny that, but I want to tell you that there is a more wonderful and profound way to be alone. So this is, of course, where the opening comes. And I think it's, just reading it now, it's a good example of how to teach or how to help somebody. You know, oftentimes we come in and we kind of tell people what's wrong with them, right? That's our kind of opening remarks. And, of course, this almost immediately what? It causes a wall to go, a barrier to cross, somebody to shut down. And so oftentimes we want to deliver a message to somebody which perhaps could be beneficial or helpful to them, but the way we go about it is often counterproductive. So I think it's interesting. The Buddha, he kind of begins by saying, it's obvious that you're somebody who likes to practice living alone. And I don't want to deny that. So he kind of acknowledges it. But then he says, but then I want to tell you about that not only the way you do it is okay, but there's a more wonderful way to do it. So he builds on what the way the man's living, again, which I think is a very good teaching device. Because he's acknowledging the worth of the person. We could say he's beginning where the person is at, right? And then he's kind of moving out from that, rather than kind of telling him, you're really making a big mistake here. You're all wrong. He says, but there is another more and wonderful, profound way to be alone. So again, in terms of those of us who try to help people, you can see he's using the language of this person. He's not saying, this stuff being alone is for lightweights, and you really got to, start being with other people, or perfect in a more profound way. He says, how wonderful, good that you enjoy practicing living alone, and would you like to learn a more wonderful way to be alone? So he's sort of working within the framework of this monk. So now he tells him, he says, this more wonderful and profound way to be alone. It is the way of deep observation in order to see that the past no longer exists and that the future has not come, and to dwell at ease in the present moment, free of desire. When a person lives in this way, she has no hesitation in her heart. She gives up all anxieties and regrets, lets go of binding desires, and cuts the fetters which prevent him or her from being free. This is called the better way to live alone. There is no more wonderful way than this. So this is, we'll spend a little time now seeing what this is. But we can see that this monk's way of living alone is very materialistic, right? I live alone, I walk alone, I beg alone, I meditate alone. There is no other person with me. So therefore, I am alone. And the Buddha says, obviously, living without a past, living without a future, living without any type of grasping, attachment, or desire, and living at ease in the present moment, this is also a way to live alone. Right? But it's an inner way. It's not an outer way. And so I think in this very simple teaching, the Buddha presents the heart of what real spirituality is about. It is very easy to approach spirituality or meditation practice or transformative type of practice as something that looks a certain way, right? Like this monk looked good in a certain way. in his capacity to live alone. He seemed to have no need for companionship, right? No need for things, right? He was very independent. He wasn't dependent. He wasn't codependent. You know, he was, he appeared good in a certain way. You know what I'm saying? But there was the inner content of his life may not have been so good. His capacity to live alone might have been based on what? Fear. Or he didn't like people. Or he didn't care about things. Or, you know, he's quite proud. You know, you go to India or places and you see these many sadhus and practitioners who practice all these kind of ascetic practices. And they're quite proud of their capacity to deny themselves things. So in other words, it just becomes a more of a self, strong self-identification. And so the Buddha presents a vision of spirituality which has nothing to do with externals, right? Because again, one can outwardly look like one is living alone, but yet one's mind could be going about it for all unhealthy reasons. So the Buddha presents the really healthy way to live alone, which again, as you notice, is not based on, you know, who you live with, who you don't live with, who you meditate with, who you don't meditate with, you know, who you beg with, who you don't beg with, right? Can you see, though, that kind of rigidity or that kind of attachment to forms? The Buddha clearly says this is not, this is, you know, a way, but this is not the wondrous way. This is not the profound way to live alone. What he presents is one can live in the midst of people. One can live in the midst of activity. One can live in the midst of things and objects and et cetera, and yet by not being attached to anything. In a certain sense, one is truly alone, but in a more wondrous way. So he says, begins, he says, it is the way of deep observation to see that the past no longer exists and the future has not come. Right? So again, we all know that, don't we? Right? I mean, this stuff is just obvious. Right? I mean, anybody, I think, with any kind of logical, rational mind would say, yes, that is true, right? The past no longer exists, right? And you know, and the future hasn't come. I mean, it's almost by definition, right? So obviously the Buddha is not just quoting definitions, because he's saying, and this is important for all of us, because again, you know, we're intelligent people, we're intellectual people. So you go, oh yeah, I get it, right? The past doesn't exist, the future hasn't come, there's no really past or future. But it doesn't change our lives. So the Buddha introduces that by saying it is the way of deep observation, so you can really see that, not think it. Because it's when we directly observe this and understand it at that deep level, then it has the power to have meaning. And for all of us who follow a spiritual path, who engage in spiritual teachings, who read about these things, talk about these things, expose ourselves to these things, it is important that we get beyond the words, concepts, and really understand deeply what these words mean, because then they have the power to transform. Right? At the intellectual level, they don't have that kind of power. So the Buddha says, you know, look deeply. So you really see clearly the past no longer exists. Right? I mean, a lot of times I'll talk to people about that and they'll go, oh yeah, I understand that. And my response is, well, if you understood, you wouldn't be having this problem. Right? Obviously you don't understand. Oh, I understand the future doesn't exist. Then if you're into the future exists, your mind would be completely free of anxiety. Because anxiety is always based on the future. You know, you don't worry about things in the past. You worry about things you think are going to happen in the future. So we have to be very careful that we just don't bandy about these words without really understanding their meaning, because when we understand it, it has profound. Right? If we really have looked deeply, does the past exist in any meaningful, real way? We would have to say, no, it is past. Everything is past. Every event in human history is past. Every event in my own life is past. Would anybody argue with me? Yes. Right. But the only event we could say that is real is this one. You think life is okay, but in that continuum, everything before this moment no longer exists. Would you grant me that? It's gone. Not practically, logically, in reality. The reality is, whatever happened, whatever I said a minute ago, is not here now, is it? Really, what's the connection? Where? No, it only has continuity in your memory of it. It is gone. I mean, you see what I'm saying? We may string it together, right? Logically and through memory. You know, I mean, those are kind of, those are human capacity. You know, I mean, we can write about history, right? We can talk about our past. You know what I'm saying? I'm not denying, but if we say in truth, you know, does this exist in any inherent existing way, we'd have to say, no. I mean, I can talk about the past, I can remember the past, I can write about the past, I can read what I wrote about it. But in truth, it is past. It no longer exists. That's all we're saying here. You see what I'm saying? And that's important, because so much of people's suffering is because to them the past is still alive. We'll talk about that. So again, this capacity of deep observation is just like we're talking about now. It's important. I mean, these are important matters because, and they're not just philosophical or intellectual. Again, if you think about, for sake of something, it's very common today. It's called depression. Depression, we know that people who have depression usually have a way of thinking about their past, which is based on what? All the things they've done wrong, all the opportunities they've missed. It's often a rumination on the suffering, difficulties, etc. It's the same way with everything we're dealing with childhood trauma, all these things. They're all what? With the past, events are still living in the person's presence, because it has a reality to it. In the same way, we could say that the future, that when one thinks that there is a reality to their thoughts, their fantasies, their projections about what's going to happen in future time, when they think that's real, right, then anxiety can occur. But if that doesn't happen, there's no anxiety that can arise in the mind. Right? Because the future has not happened. It is a total made-up fantasy. It doesn't mean that one can't think about it, and one can't project various kinds of scenarios about how one future may unfold or may not unfold, right? But that is just thought. Right? That's not reality. It hasn't happened yet. And so to be able to project things about the future, if that's a meaningful, helpful way, it's fine. But the suffering that comes from anxiety, or the suffering that comes constantly from people's disappointment with their expectations, right? Which is another big one. Right? People have expectations. Right? People might come here tonight and have an expectation. How it's going to be, or how I'm going to be, or you're going to be, or the meditation is going to be, or the night's going to be, right? And then if life doesn't live up to the expectation, we are what? We're frustrated, we're angry, we're disappointed, we're this or that. We don't realize that what? That whole thing that we called an expectation was made up. It wasn't real, it never was real. And so, all your disappointments in life are like that. If you have disappointments in your life, it's because you had some made up image, thought, visualization, concept about how something was going to turn out. That's not reality, is it? Reality is what unfolds in reality. This moment is reality. And even that discussion we had 2 minutes ago doesn't exist anymore. We may remember it, for those of you with good memory. Right? And so, when the Buddha says, please come to an understanding of these things through deep observation, this is what he means. Because again, intellectually it is very easy to understand these things. But if we don't really ponder them deeply, not only at times of meditation and reflection, but also, I think even more worthy, when we get caught. Right? When you realize you're going through a disappointment, or some kind of dissonance because something has not worked out the way you thought it would work out, or someone's not seeing the way you wanted them to be, or, you know, whatever's happening, or history's not unfolding, you know, the way you wanted it to be, or the president's not, you know what I mean? You know, it's like all those things aren't real. Those expectations aren't real. That's all they ever were. And it's important to understand that. To see if that's true. So, it is the way of deep observation in order to see that the past no longer exists, the future has not come, and to dwell at ease in the present moment, free from desire. This is a very simple teaching, but very profound, right? It's what I'm saying. If one gets it, and if one no longer is living always in the past, identifying with the past, seeing one's present in terms of the past, and if one is no longer always looking in the future, always kind of, you know, bending into the future, you know, living, looking forward, a lot of people always looking forward to the future. Right? But if that's all gone, well then what's left? This present moment. And the Buddha says what? We need to learn to dwell at ease in the present moment. Now obviously, if there isn't this overwhelming rumination and about the past, and if there isn't this endlessly worrying about, thinking about, expecting, etc., looking forward to the future, then what is left with is what? The present. So, in truth, this is all we have. Right? So then the obvious question is, well, how should I be in this moment? At ease. At ease. And obviously, if your life is not a constant seesaw between the past and the future, it's obviously much easier to be at ease. And how does the Buddha say to be at ease? Free from desire. It's really, I think, the translation, I think it means free from grasping. Which means whatever is arising, whatever is happening, whatever is being experienced in this present moment, I am present to. But I'm not constricting around it. I'm not holding on to around it. I'm not fixating around it. I'm not caught. Right? A lot of people talk about wanting to live life more like a flow. You know, the flow. That's what the Buddha was talking about 2,500 years ago. When you're living at ease in the present, you're in the flow. Because you're just moving along with experience. You're not always struggling with it, manipulating it, right? Pushing it, pulling it, fighting it. You're at ease. You're totally present. And the next line is interesting. So when a person lives this way of no longer living in the past, no longer living in the future, and living at ease in the present, free from grasping. Again, desire, people get hung up on that word. When the Buddha says free from desire, it doesn't mean like, you know, you can't say I'm hungry. Gee, I'd like to have whatever I'd like to have for dinner, you know what I mean? Or it might be nice to go. It doesn't mean like those kind of ordinary desires of the heart aren't arising. It just means there's no grasping, you know. They're not like, you know, so if I don't get it, I'm going to be frustrated or disappointed or hurt, or you know what I mean? This one is at ease. Right? So I'd like that, but if that doesn't work, that's okay too. Right? It's that kind of ease, as opposed to some people, everything is so important. This is when a person lives in this way, he or she has no hesitation in their heart. So again, I don't know what the, you know, these are all translated. These are translated from the Pali. So, you know, when a translator you know, there's never a one-to-one between Pali and English. So, you know, translators almost taking two different universes and trying to, you know, taking this thing in Pali, which may mean a whole bunch of words and a whole bunch of feelings, situations, and saying, now what would an English equivalent be? So that's why you can look at various translators trying to do the same text, but it seems like a very different text because of that. So he says, anyway, he says, when a person lives in this way, he or she has no hesitation in their heart. You know how many people can say that their heart is that natural and free? That there's not all kinds of hesitations, all kinds of holding back, all kinds of calculations, all kinds of checking things out, all kinds of protection and projections, right? Endlessly covering our heart that causes it to hesitate in its capacity to just come forward openly and naturally in all situations. We could say almost that without the child, it's a child's heart. You know, a child's heart, again, in the purest sense. And all of us one day, hopefully, were children and had one and had an opportunity at some point in our life to experience that heart that doesn't hesitate. Because it's very open and embracing. And, you know, I think that's again why we like being around young children. It's a great opportunity. Because oftentimes, their hearts are. There's no hesitation. In a certain way, I think that's why people these days, many people seem to prefer pets to human beings. Again, because it seems as if oftentimes that unhesitating heart seems to be more present in their dog than in their in the family or social relationships. It could be a sad commentary on where we've evolved to. But again, maybe that's some of it too. Our pets are very open-hearted with us. They don't hold back. They seem to know how to be happy when they see us. And we're naturally what? We're happy when we see them. So it's a wonderful kind of responsiveness with no hesitation. So when a person lives in this way, he or she has no hesitation in their heart. He or she gives up all anxieties and regrets, anxieties about the future and regrets about the past. Let's go of all these binding desires. Again, that sense is unbinding, right? Not a desire, but the desires that bind us, that tie us up, that constrict us and constrain us and prevent us from just flowing along with life. And cuts the fetters which prevent us from being free. This is called the better way to live alone. There is no more wonderful way of being alone than this. And then the Buddha recited this katha or poem, which again you find a lot in Buddha sutras. You'll find a kind of a textual development. And then at the end you'll find the same thing, like a poem, kind of going over the same territory. And again, I think this was just part of the memorization. So he has a little poem here. The Buddha was a spontaneous poet. Modern day, what do they call the ones? Rappers or something, you know, kind of putting it all together in verse form, you know. The Buddha was doing that. And so he says, observing life deeply, it is possible to clearly see all that is, not enslaved by anything. It is possible to put aside all craving, resulting in a life of peace and joy. This is truly to live alone. Hearing the Buddha's words, the monk Tara was delighted. He prostrated respectfully to the Buddha and departed. So it kind of has a happy ending. He was delighted with the teaching. He wasn't offended. Many of us would be offended. How dare anybody tell me about my life, how I could be doing it better. Most of us are very ego attached to our life, and we're not open to somebody looking in and giving us wise advice. But obviously the monk Tara, even though he had obviously had a very a defined way of living and whatever, kind of got it, didn't he? And he let it in and he was grateful. Thank you. Thank you, Buddha, for showing me a better way to live alone. So I can be much freer and happier. I don't have to only do it one way. See, in that monk's way, it was very rigid. Right? Stay alone, walk alone, live alone, meditate alone, beg alone. Right? Very rigid life. The Buddha's life, the Buddha's teaching, was the opposite of rigidity, because it was all about the internal transformation of the heart mind. Not about externally how one lives. So it was a deeper teaching that the Buddha was giving to the monk Tara, and the monk Tara was delighted. Nice word. Prostrated respect to the Buddha and departed. So I don't know if you're delighted with his teaching, but I'm interested whether everybody here believes they can easily practice this. Because again, that's what it's about, right? I mean, we can come, we can go, oh, that's interesting, we can walk out of here and we can continue, you know, same old thing, right? We can even walk out of here and, you know, start ruminating about the past and worrying about the future, having, you know, building on our expectations, right? As if we never heard this. Right? So let's just spend a few minutes thinking, is this a bunch of hogwash? Spiritual gobbledygook? New Age babble? Or is this timeless wisdom and insight which speaks to us in our lives the same way it spoke to the monk at Terra 2,600 years ago, a long time ago. So anybody want to comment on their capacity to practice this? Yes. And well, Terry, you have something first?
I did.
I just wrote it in the front row.
I was thinking, to have that ratio of fire, because in order to have that ratio of fire, in my experience, there's going to be a role of other people filling that ratio of fire. The ratio of fire would be the background of it. If I'm living with clothes with my friends, they're all engaged in the conversation. It's a pleasant experience. I feel that race is a part. I don't have to advance it. I'm not getting my pizza on upset. I could care less. All I have to do is have a pizza. If I'm alone or in some spiritual way, I feel the void. I'd be more likely. So that's a good point. Obviously, the Buddha lived in community. The Buddha, you know, right from his first teaching, when he in his first teaching and collected his first half dozen disciples, for the next 49 years of his life, he lived in community. I mean, he lived, you know, when it was a growing community. You know, 10, 20, 30, 100, you know, after a while it became a whole quite a production. And they kind of split in various ways. But, right, he always lived in community. And obviously, there's something very rich about that. Obviously, there's something very supportive about that. And certainly, to learn to get one's needs met by rich human experience rather than through means that aren't productive, you know, such as pizza. Nothing against pizza, but, you know, always wanting things and getting things and needing things and wanting things. Obviously, to learn to get one's happiness and fulfillment of the heart from kind of meaningful experiences with one human being is quite very rich. And it's obviously good to have spiritual friends. You know, in the Buddhist tradition, there's a term for that. It's called kalyanamitta, which really sort of means spiritual friends. And it really helps us understand that while we can have you know, ordinary friends, good friends, and family we love and care about, they might not necessarily really nurture those things that are going on in terms of our own personal transformation, spiritual path, and all that. And that to have friends who nurture all those qualities that we're trying to bring in our life, which are new, it is important to have spiritual friends. Both spiritual friends that are peers, which means our peers mean they're our peers and they're walking the same path as us, but also the spiritual friends who are, so to say, our elders, you know, so they can show us the way and mentor us and guide us and support us. And when we have that type of community that has elders, that has mentors and teachers, etc., and also has peer companions on the way, that certainly makes it not only easier in our own personal transformation, but it makes it more enjoyable. Because in a certain way, not in a certain way, an obvious way, we are social. Most of us are very social beings. We do enjoy traditionally living in community. You know, traditionally, the community might have been big extended families, clans, tribes, close-knit neighborhoods, etc. But with less of those types of traditional communities available to us, there's a greater need for other types of communities, such as this community or other communities, of like-minded people, to develop that kind of connection, supportive connection to one another. Thank you. Are there questions about whether we can bring this practice into our life? Now Terry's going to speak.
I think he was looking at him as not being alone. I mean, he was living, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he was, the action in his head that was keeping him alone. Because the Buddha was talking about being alone in the sense of being free.
Right.
I think he saw him as that. He said, hey, you bring this guy over here.
Yeah.
So, your first question was really, about putting this into practice.
Mm-hmm.
For the, I found this rare part to do. It's easy to do it sitting here and talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment in the present when the world is, we're interacting with the world, to remain present to the fact that it's not real is very difficult.
So this is very important, and I think that's where he used the words. The first thing he said before he talked about no past, no future was deep observation. I think that's the answer, Terry. We have to, because you're right. Now again, one of the things that we do when we come, to like our weekly meditations, our group meditations, or what hopefully people have a daily meditation practice in their home, in that moment, you're right, it's kind of ideal conditions. and that's good. It's like doing experiments in the lab. First, we're going to see whether they can, even work in the lab, before we kind of take it out and replicate it in with other kinds of real-life variables. So in that sense, on the mat, with the support of others and the quiet and the structure, we're learning how just to be. Can I just be for 30 minutes sitting, walking, be calm within myself, right? And even though thoughts arise in past, future, can I learn to just let them go? So, in a certain sense, what we're doing on the mat, we need to learn to do in our life, but we're getting a taste of it. I can sit here, talk about today, yesterday, the dramas of my life, and I can see them, and I can let them go. And I can come back to my breath and stay calm and centered. So, in this more formal practice, we're getting a taste of it, right? We're kind of learning how to do it, we could say, in somewhat ideal. And obviously, doing days of mindfulness, going on retreats, longer retreats, kind of deepen and extend that capacity. But still, and I recommend all that stuff because I think it's very beneficial, still, the true test is how we live our life in the world. I mean, that's the test of our practice. And I think there is that capacity to observe. You know what I mean? I have to, part of the observation is just as you say, is the willingness to over and over and over and over. And let me say again, over and over and over and over, and let me say again, over and over and over and over, getting caught and getting unstuck. I mean, that's the practice. And we don't like that, because we'd like to walk out of here, right? I mean, I think it's a chronic disappointment to everyone that it's as hard as it is. That something that is so easy, you know, yet in the reality of life is so hard, because our habit energy is so always to go out and get caught, right? Right, and that's exactly what the Buddha teaches. You're saying, yeah, you know, you got it because you are cutting yourself off from you know, you're living alone, you're walking alone. You know, I mean, that's like saying, it's like at the end of which he could go, no, I have no conflict with anybody, right? You know, I don't know why all you have such relationship problems and I don't have any. But you know, he doesn't have any because he has cut himself off. He lives alone in that physical sense. And you're exactly right. The Buddha is saying that's not it, because it is a very, it's not real spiritual development, because, you know, if you took this guy who could be very peaceful, right, a very calm, peaceful mind in that life he's living, you know, and throw him into, throw him into family life or something, you know, all of a sudden it can completely fall apart. So that peace of mind and stability was situational. And so, I mean, so again, I mean, the practice is the willingness, you know, to develop an understanding, a deep understanding of what the teachings and practices are about, to want to realize them, and then to go out in the world and just, you know, keep doing it. And you get caught, and you see your caught, and you let go. And you get it, and 10 minutes later, you get caught again, and you let go. And if you keep that persistent kind of practice, it does transform. But, you know, the world appears a certain way. It feels very solid and real and important, etc. Right? And if you're in this world and you're on the internet and you're reading the newspaper and you're talking to everybody, everybody is bought into that. Right? And everybody's talking about the past and the future. You know? And that's the language of our society. And obviously there's a lot of pain and suffering and neuroses and mental illness and drug addiction and everything else in our society because of that. So, again, coming back, what's your name? Bart, that's right, Bart. You know, that is the importance of having a spiritual teaching, having a community, having all those things to support us. So we have, you know, as we spiritual warriors in the world, doing our best to see clearly and openly, and to remain at ease in the midst of all the activity. You know, we need things to be constantly feeding us and supporting us, but that's the practice. So, I mean, usually I say to people when they get frustrated, go, God, you know, I've had this 20 years and I'm still, it's like, yeah, but I would imagine it's not like it was 20 years ago, you know? And I think there's a truth in that. You know, it's not as overwhelming as it was 20, 10 years ago. I don't get caught as deeply. I don't get caught as long. You know what I'm saying? And from that point of view, you see, oh, yeah, I am tedious. You know, but it's, yeah.
I've heard everything
I've
really got it, so now I'm really a spiritual person.
Yeah. But again, that's an expectation we have of how we're supposed to be, and the truth is it's just unfolding. We're a spiritual person because we live our life that way. You know, it's not because we've perfected it. It's because, you know, this is the path we're walking on. Right? I mean, you know, when you're a mountain climber, you're not always at the height with the vast views. A lot of times it's pretty miserable, right? But you're on the path, and you know where you're going, and you know when you get to the top of the mountain, that's where you want to get to. But if we've ever been in the Himalayas, it's like whoop. Just when you think you're over, you're going down again. So anyway, any questions? Yeah, did you have a question? You know, again, I think what you're saying is, again, absolutely true. One is one needs a spiritual path. One needs a framework, whatever that framework. I'm not saying Buddhism is, you know, there's many different spiritual paths, but one needs ultimately, after one has shopped around and checked it out, you know, one needs a framework so as one's going through life and dealing with things, one has a framework to deal with it, understand it, etc. But the other thing he's saying is also key. And in Thich Nhat Hanh, he often talks about, he says, stopping looking deeply. It's like, and, you know, in here the Buddha talks about, you know, observe deeply. Well, if you don't stop, you can't observe deeply. And so you're absolutely right. Our first practice is, you know, to get more, and again, this is, again, comes back to our practice of mindfulness, or just being aware of what's going on inside us. You know, when you're beginning to feel that constriction inside, that tightening, that fixation, that frustration, and, you know, hurt, whatever it is going, whatever it is, you know, rather than keep going, you know. So this is like, to me, the first rule of this is, if we can just learn to stop. You know, we're dealing with couples and communication, you know, just, if you could just learn to close your mouth and keep it closed. You know, until you really have something that'll be meaningful or helpful to say, just don't open your mouth, you know, carry duct tape with you, you know. Right? That stopping, and it's so hard for us. Right? Just do right. No, yeah. I'm getting a little off here, something's off, I'm getting a little tight, not feeling good, I'm getting a little angry, getting a little down, you know. Something. Stop. Pull back. Take some breath. Get clear. You know, look, then look deeply. You know, what's going on here? And if we don't stop, our habit energy from the past will just take us down the same worn path that we've always gone down. It's guaranteed. Because that's our default. That we always have done it. And if we don't stop and create some openness and space in which we can do something different, see it differently, respond differently, we'll just endlessly keep, recreating our patterns over and over again. And so I agree. I mean, stopping comes before the deep looking, before the observation. If we don't stop, we won't have that space in our mind to see what's going on and then to choose consciously to do something different. Stopping. Key. Mary? And then we'll stop.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank the Buddha. So, thank you all. It's always interesting to read the teachings that are 2,600 years ago and see, you know, human situation hasn't changed that much. Still sort of dealing with the same thing, and some of the same wisdom is still very meaningful and helpful to us. So thank you all for coming.